You're listening to Agenda on the wireless from Age UK. I'm Martin Lewis. Now, with the number of people aged 60 and over expected to pass the 20 million mark by 2030, there are clearly both challenges and opportunities ahead for our society. Ian Spiro is a social entrepreneur who thinks that innovation offers a way forward, and so he set up the Agile Aging Allowance, and I'm delighted that Ian is joining us now in the studio. Ian, tell us all about it. When did you create the Agile Aging Alliance and what inspired you?
I was introduced to this scenario by an organisation called Innovate UK, which is the National Innovation Agency. It's the way that the government stimulates small businesses to help them to realise their potential through funding. And they had been working on a programme called the Long-Term Care Revolution. And the idea behind this initiative was to reimagine ageing and to deinstitutionalise long-term care. And they reached out to me. I'm actually a marketeer, a career marketeer. I run marketing businesses. And for personal reasons, I took an active interest in healthcare. I won't go into that now. But they asked if I would come on board and help to frame this challenge, to engage what they call unusual suspects, i.e. people and organizations that wouldn't necessarily engage in the aging scenario. So I came along and helped Innovate UK to frame this competition, which was a £5 million initiative designed to encourage new ideas so small businesses could compete for 100% funding to come up with ideas that would make a difference.
And was it a wide brief? Was it any ideas that will help in any way in the process of aging?
That was the beauty of it. Completely wide, completely open, thinking outside the box.
And who did you pitch that to? I mean, was it an open canvas? Could any company that was involved in innovation of any kind apply its thinking and its talents to coming up with, well, I suppose, to lateral thinking?
You've just written the brief. That's precisely what we had in mind. But it's easier said than done, because if you are a public organisation, you generally communicate with the same audience. It's difficult to actually reach new and fresh audiences, in particular the kind of entrepreneurs that operate in Shoreditch and Manchester and Cardiff. All around the country, there are these clusters of innovators who are not used to securing public funding. They think there's too much red tape. They think that perhaps it's not for them. It's more for academics. So we had to reach out to these, what we call unusual suspects, to convince them that the brief that you described was worth their while thinking about. And the way that we did that was to pull together stakeholders across different sectors who wouldn't normally speak to each other. And we started off with a bank, NatWest Bank, because they didn't have a per se vested interest in this scenario. So they helped us by providing the space at their various headquarters across the country to organise gatherings where we brought these different stakeholders together to explore what might be and to introduce different stakeholders so that perhaps you get a scenario, ideally, where one and one make three.
And were you able to stimulate lots of ideas through that technique?
We were able to stimulate lots of ideas, and furthermore, we were very pleased that the applications for the competition itself in the what they called the National Challenge, that was in 2015, were record numbers, so far more than had been originally anticipated. But perhaps more importantly, two-thirds of them had not previously applied for Innovate UK or TSB, Technology Strategy Board, as it was at the time, funding. So yes, we had some really good ideas, but I suppose more to the point, we've created a movement, if you will, because the people that came together who would normally not meet each other, so you had people from the IT sector, you had people from the finance sector, you had people from social care, digital health, construction, they would normally go to their own conferences and work in vertical. So here we created a situation where they met people and thought about things in a different way. So though we invited them to join a LinkedIn group in the first instance, the other thing that I wanted to do in terms of framing this opportunity was again to address one of the key problems, which is language. Aging, by and large, especially the elderly in inverted commas, are almost prejudiced against. I mean, you read in the paper every day about the problems, right? So from a marketing point of view, this was a crucial consideration. So my starting point was to reframe the scenario of the long-term care revolution, which I called agile aging, because having, you know, conducted research amongst various audiences, the idea of agile aging with a technological emphasis and agility, etc., it's timeless, and that's what we were trying to do. So we started off with the agile aging piece, and then in terms of the people who attended the event, they joined the LinkedIn group, and we called the LinkedIn group the Agile Aging Alliance. So that's really how it began. And then one of the partners that we brought into the equation was the European Commission. And the rationale for that was, we are talking to small businesses. And when I talk about small businesses and entrepreneurs, we're not talking necessarily about young people. We are talking about all sorts of people, because you're never too old to start a business. You have the opportunity in this day and age, especially in the UK, to really make a difference. Because
So you had some older entrepreneurs taking part in this, as well as the thrusting young bucks with all the new ideas.
Well, that was the beauty of it. Not only did we have the older ones, but by forging an alliance between the old and the young, we were able to create a new kind of dynamic.
So what kind of ideas do they come up with? Tell me what sort of things are there.
There are so many. I mean, one of the interesting ones that I'm looking at the moment is, you know what a chatbot is?
You better explain to our listeners what
Okay, a chatbot is effectively an Alexa. The Amazon device is a chat box.
It sits in your kitchen and you tell it you want it to play any record, or you want it to find out something for you, and it thinks a bit and then it answers back.
Exactly. Now, we've obviously got these on our mobile devices anyway, and these kind of...
Yes, with Siri and so on.
Precisely. Yeah. These voice-activated, what's called ambient computing, has been around for a long time. But Amazon have cut through and have captured people's imaginations. And so that's a starting point. So you've got a level of intelligence, a level of artificial intelligence. And we've all heard about AI being the new flavor of the day, but we're in the stone age of AI. And this is representative of that. So, for example, that there is one which I'm looking at the moment, which is actually specifically designed to appeal to an aging population, to have an affinity with an aging population.
Yes, because that, of course, is part of the challenge of information technology, that a lot of older people are resistant to it. So to have a piece of information technology that is instinctively attractive to older people would make a lot of difference. You then find quite a speedy take-up.
Exactly, because they're not older people. They are, of course, but in fact, they're ordinary people. We're all... You know, the reality is we are either familiar with something or we're not. And even if you're young, if you're not familiar with something, you're not necessarily going to embrace it. So I'll give you an example. My dad is 92. No, he will be. He's actually going to be 90 in April. Sorry about that, Dad. But he's getting there. And the thing is that my sister bought him an iPad, and he plays occasionally. But not too much. However, at Christmas, we bought him an Alexa. And it's his new girlfriend, he calls it, because he has a conversation. Mm. He is very interested in history. And he can ask this device historic facts, and it comes back with the answers, whereas he's got tons of books, and he absolutely loves it. So he's found a way of relating, which is just the beginning. So in that context, once you've got that level of familiarity, then you can start building bridges. And as I say, as an example of a small business and entrepreneurial setup, there is a company that I'm working on that's involved in developing one specifically for an aging population. There are sensors around.
Right, so it's sensors around the house combined with this Alexa or its equivalent, and older people can interrogate, ask questions. Can they shout for help when they need it?
So, yes is the answer. However, going back to your previous question, there are lots of small businesses building devices and applications and solutions and services that have not yet come together.
Okay, well, give me an example of the kind of help that they will be able to provide if they do come together, because that has to be your ultimate judgment as whether something's going to work or is likely to work.
Precisely. This is what we call the cognitive home. We published a white paper last year called Neighbourhoods of the Future, where following research and working across Europe with the European Commission, we were able to identify the trends and where the market is going. And effectively, if you can imagine a car 10, 15 years ago, it was a box with four wheels, and depending on how much you spent, it would get from A to B faster or in more comfort, in a nutshell. Today, even the cheapest car has a level of IT, of technology, that you take for granted. And it's the same with the home. At the moment, the home is an inanimate object with your furnishings and a bit of tech here and there. In future, in the very near future, in fact, you will start to see cognitive homes whereby you will have technology in those homes that will support independent living, that will help people to retain their independence for longer. And by way of example, you will have sensors, not sensors that watch you, but actually sensors that are there just to monitor the rhythm of your life. They will notice if something goes amiss. For example, you have a habit of moving and getting out of bed at a particular time. If you are not out of bed 4 or 5 hours later, it will notice something is wrong, and it can actually look in, or it can allow somebody who is your carer or somebody who is an organization that is empowered to look in just to check that everything is all right. You will also be able to have devices that you wear that will extend that confidence that you will have. And I'm not talking about cowbells around your neck with a big button on it that says, I am elderly, help me. But actually things that baby boomers who do not necessarily conform to the elderly, but are actually interested in buying and wearing things that they like. So things that you can actually enjoy wearing that will also just keep an eye on you.
And one of those things will be, I gather, some kind of a overall health monitor, so that if there are any causes for concern, they will be relayed automatically to your GP.
Exactly. And you can take that a step further, which again is not too far away, where it becomes preventative, which is more important, i.e. identifying if there is a problem on its way.
So the warning signs, you know, before you, the patient, start to feel them, the system that you've got, which would be what, implanted under your skin?
Or? No. First and foremost, we're not talking about patients. Because if we're talking about prevention, you're not a patient yet, and you shouldn't be thinking of yourself as a patient. You're thinking of yourself as an older person. But as an older person, you're likely to get more frail. That's fact of life. So by way of example, there was a test in America last year whereby they monitored two sets of apartments with single adults in their 70s and 80s over a period of 2 years. One of the apartments had a new sensor set up, the other one didn't. Those were the new sensors. Monitored the movement of that older adult and were able to predict 6 months in advance that somebody was going to actually have a fall. 6 months in advance. And they were able to actually work out that potentially gave the people who were living in that environment 2 years extra life based upon the number of fatalities from the Falls. So it's actually, and the way that works is because people have a rhythm. And it's minute. And the only way you can measure it is using these digital devices. So you can actually predict. So it's as good as that. Plus, you'll have a situation whereby your toilet, for example, your toilet can actually monitor your well-being by actually examining your stool. You know, and not at the moment. These are things that are being tested. But just imagine that...
So if there's blood, if there's any blood, which would indicate colon... illness of some kind.
No, because you're looking at human reference there. That's what we can do already, i.e. if you look in the toilet and you see blood, then you go to the doctor. I'm talking about things you can't see. I'm talking about chemical testing to analyse your well-being in real time. This is inevitable.
So how far away are we from a totally controlled environment where you can be looked after if you're living alone in a house by a whole series of technical, digital, IT devices and so on? Or is it going to be a matter of an incremental arrival of these devices? So you'll have one that turns on the oven when you're 20 minutes away from the house, which is there now, of course. But before you get the total global package, it's going to be quite a while, is it?
There's three answers to that question. One, there is no such thing as a total global package, as there isn't in terms of, even if you wanted, for getting health, the ultimate kitchen. There is always something more that you can buy if you've got the money in that ultimate kitchen. It's up to you. It's about choice. So in that regard...
And what you can afford, of course.
Well, of course. Absolutely. But in that regard, we don't have a market yet. Once there is a market for these kind of devices where you can pick and choose... then you can start to move in the direction you're talking about. But it will always be incremental, because by creating a market, you will create an ongoing supply and demand. So companies will come up with new ideas.
And people are genuinely interested in what more they can have to help them around the house. So you've got that as a starting point. And then it all comes down to cost and whether the individual can afford it. If some of this new digital world that you're creating is going to help a great many people, will there be a case for government helping out in order to install these devices in the homes of people who mightn't otherwise be able to afford them?
Absolutely. But I think that that's twofold. One, government helping small businesses to make more products so you've got more choice and therefore it's cheaper devices.
And helping the individuals to afford them.
That's the second thing. Yeah. As far as the individuals are concerned, I think there's a tendency towards having your own health budgets and care budgets so you can cherry pick what you want to pay for, supported by government. So there has to be a hybrid, a new way of doing things. But the other point I wanted to make in regard to this notion of a utopia of technology, please do not get concerned that we will be in a situation where we've become, as I like to put it, isolated in a gilded technology cage. Because technology alone is not the answer. Technology should be an enabler, but the human touch will never go away. The thing that technology can do, because, you know, we all know about loneliness, we all know about the need for human contact.
A big issue at the moment.
It's crucial. So technology can make it easier for carers, be it professional or family, friends, whatever.
So the challenge is going to be, as we embrace these new technologies in the home, to make sure that they are not allowed to squeeze out the human contact, the neighbour dropping in, you know, going down to some kind of a, you know, an HUK meeting place in the local village or the local town. That must not be replaced by, if you like, the ease of all these digital products making you feel very comfortable in your own home.
They won't be squeezed out. You see, this is the fear that's being peddled, and it always has been in technology terms, in terms of the robots taking over the world. The reality is we have always, throughout history, made technology work for us to our advantage. And then if there is a market that demands that, because we're people, you know, we have that choice. And that choice will not be taken away. No government is going to impose technology on people. It is a matter of common sense. And if you've got younger family that have an interest in this, they can help to select what is the best technology out there. But an example that I find the best in all of this is, again, taking the prime example, what's the most common technological aid that we see for older people? It's the things you wear around your neck. Yep. That basically locates...
The button you can press when you need some help.
Exactly. Now, those have... I've not seen one which isn't damn ugly.
Yes.
Really? And why would you impose that on somebody? Imagine if Apple created such a device. In reality, that is what we're looking to.
It would be on your wrist, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm wearing one on my wrist, and that serves the same purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're moving into that kind of seamless, invisible technology scenario. Kimberly Clark, the makers of Kleenex, they were working on a mobile shop idea where they designed some amazing walking sticks and mobility devices that looked like Apple would have made them. Mm. So super cool sticks in nice colours. You'd feel good using it. And mobility devices that you feel good using. My mum was living with cancer for 6 years and went through 3 mobility scooter scenarios. And my mum was style first, right? And she went out there and found the best she could. But as her mobility kind of reduced, she couldn't drive the big one that she started with. And by the time that she got to her final scooter thing, she was embarrassed about it because it says, I am an invalid. Mm-hmm. And that's ridiculous. Why not create mobility devices that actually support independent living that you'd want to use?
So you've got people working on that.
There are people working on that. There are, you know, there are the autonomous vehicle scenarios that are being developed. Sure. They're not a million miles removed from what we're talking about here. So the world is a changing, and it's changing positively.
There is an evolutionary process going on because all these diverse organisations and people you've brought together are being forced to, if you like, invade each other's territory a bit to try to come up with new ideas.
I love that. Invading each other's territory. Absolutely perfect. Plus, the crucial consideration is getting the users involved, i.e. older adults. Now, when you say older adults, you can't really just say, here is one older example, here is our representative sample, because we're all different. Mm. And that's crazy. You can't do that. But we've got some user groups. So there are older adult groups, and there's one in particular here, the University of the Third Age, which I think is brilliant. My dad belongs to it. He follows archaeology through it. Yeah. And I think, you know, organizations like that have a part to play.
So they're feeding in reaction to these new ideas as they develop. And there is, as you clearly indicated, there is a changing mindset in the part of companies, or the part of companies. What are the next steps for you? Is it simply more of the same? Is it going down that same path? In fact, it's a continuous path with no end, really.
There should be an end. The government is committed to the Industrial Strategy Challenge, which is an initiative which they launched last year with £400 billion to promote sectors, emerging sectors where the UK can make a real difference. And for example, last year they committed to autonomous vehicles, new ways of developing batteries, quantum technology. They are thinking about supporting the aging society and healthy aging. This is not... this was announced as a possibility publicly quite recently. Nothing has been written in stone yet, but I do believe that the support of government in a very different way, government working with small businesses, but also academics that are committed to impact, not research for the sake of research, although there's a place for that, but applied research, where you're actually looking at what can you think about and how quickly can you move it to market? And also, critically, what's missing from the market that doesn't exist at the moment are the big companies. You need big corporations, big brands, because they're the ones who know how to grow.
Right, and presumably those big brands are constantly looking at what they can invent for the market. So they're, in a sense, already doing a bit of what you're trying to do as well, because every company would have its own research department saying what can we make to help people in this new way using new technology that's around. So that would be happening anyway.
Well, that's kind of old school. The reality of today is that the big companies, the big corporate giants, in order to compete with the entrepreneurs, the agile companies, their R&D departments are not as agile. They're quite slow, in fact. So what we're starting to see is a lot of corporate venturing, where big companies are aligning themselves with small businesses that are innovating in their space.
So the big companies are actively hunting down these new fresh ideas because they haven't been able to generate them themselves. So there is this partnership developing between big business and small and medium-sized businesses to try to come up with some really new and exciting ideas. How can people keep in touch with what you're doing?
People are very welcome to join the Agile Aging Alliance LinkedIn group. That's the easiest way of doing it. That's our website is agileaging.org.
Yeah.
Alternatively, if they have something quite specific they want to propose, and we're very open, there is on the website a way of reaching out to us, and we have as an address info@agileaging.org.
So if anybody is out there listening who has got an idea or has seen a need for which there could be a digital solution, they can actually put that request into you and say, I've got a problem here. Can you get your team of companies working on this for us to see if they can come up with a solution?
That's an ideal scenario. In reality, in terms of our bandwidth, we're limited as to what we can do. The way that that kind of scenario works is by joining in the LinkedIn group and seeing what other people are doing and sharing information. Yeah. That's the best way that we can deal with that. At the front end, we are initiating the kind of ideas that we talked about earlier in terms of having events where we bring people together and look at specific challenges. And the other thing that we're doing is through our Neighbourhood of the Future project, we are looking at what a prototype neighbourhood might look like. And we've just announced that we're going to be implementing the second stage of that, which will be published in September of this year. And that is supported by Tata Steel.
Right. So we've already had interviews on this program about dementia-friendly town centres. So it would be that kind of thing which you would be looking at to basically make neighbourhoods, what, more friendly?
More than just friendly, because there are so many. Once I started looking into this space with an open mind, so to speak, there are so many things you have to think about. For example, you do not want to create, as I've seen, ghettos, which are just for older people. So older buildings that are particularly designed for older people. They did that in Switzerland, in a very, very rich area in Switzerland. And they had this competition and they made the ideal apartment blocks with a health centre attached to it. After 4 years, they're having to stop it because older people feel like they're being ghettoized. They feel like they're not aligning. So you've got to have alignment with younger people. So that's one of the key considerations. Don't just build for older people. Secondly, as I mentioned before, the idea of a technologically gilded cage is crazy. If you create the ideal environment that makes it easier and desirable for somebody who's getting on to be able to live independently, you don't want them to be afraid of going outdoors. So you've got to look at the urban environment. You've got to actually think about street furniture, how that can change as well. Lighting becomes a crucial consideration. Accessibility in every sense, because some people will have disability, but then there are younger people with disability. So when you're starting to think about this universally, it's not just older people, you know, it's for life, effectively.
And it's ironic that what you are trying to do with all the digital tools at your disposal is creating the kind of community that maybe used to exist 50, 60 or 100 years ago. So, but it's basically making it, it's digitizing it, but it's a community where people get on with each other and understand where everyone is coming from and are tolerant of that.
Martin, I don't know if people will be able to hear this, but I'm going to give you a high five.
We have a high five.
That was
five.
A high five because you've actually hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it comes down to. It's breaking down those obstacles that society has created for itself and creating a scenario where people do want to hang out together, just making it easier and make, you know, using the technology to brush all of this prejudice and debris away.
Ian Spiro, thanks very much indeed for taking us through this amazing work that that you are pulling together. The website, agileaging.org, and if you want to send an email, it's info@agileaging.org. Thanks very much for joining us, and good luck. And as the new discoveries and developments come in to help people around the home and around their communities, perhaps you'll keep us up to speed and come back and tell us about them.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much, Martin.
Thanks, Ian.